Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. I'm Joe Earp. I'm joined by my despairing co-host, Daniel Dixon.
Dan Dixon, here I am. We have just watched Across the Tracks, a film starring Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's third.
Dan, you got a
pour energy into it, all right. Yeah. It's a film starring Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
He's pretty good in it, actually. Is the one good thing that can be said about this film.
We watched the film. As Dan said, it's Brad Pitt's third film. It's called Across the Tracks. So he was in like a film called Dark Side of the Sun, which was the second episode of this podcast.
Episode 2 of the Brad Pitt Cast.
Yeah, because our first episode was about Ad Astra, because we were looking at here's where Brad Pitt is now, and then we went back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I had watched this film a number of years ago when I was extremely stoned, and I must have stopped it halfway through because I did not remember anything that this film ends up as.
Okay.
If you listen to our last episode, which was about the film Cutting Class, at the end of that episode, I say to Dan, have you seen Across the Tracks? And you say,
I say, what do you think?
Which I just want to pick up on, like, a week later. As we went through also in last week's episode, Dan has the world's craziest DVD collection.
Okay.
And if that DVD collection tells me anything, it's that I have no way of predicting what you've watched.
That's fair. I do. I am surprising occasionally. My film knowledge, as we have discussed previously, is vastly inferior to Joe's. But I have a slightly eclectic...
You have pockets. Say things to me that you've seen, like you've seen the Brad Pitt film Troy.
I have seen Troy. I saw it at the cinema with my mother.
And that's, like, I would not have predicted that you've seen Troy.
Yeah, fair enough.
I will admit that Across the Tracks was... I risked a lot. It was a big bet, and I came up empty-handed, but...
Imagine if I'd seen... I feel like 8 people have seen this film, maybe.
200 people have logged it on Letterboxd.
Okay.
Some of those people have given it 4.5 stars. There are at least 4 people.
That makes me feel like... any conception I have that I might have some understanding of what we share in common as the human condition is unmoored from reality, because how on earth could someone watch this film and give it 4.5 stars?
Maybe if this was your introduction to cinema as a concept.
just visuals.
Yeah.
You've never seen, art.
Or you've never seen Brad Pitt.
That's...
Maybe you're like, this man is extremely attractive.
He's going to be a star.
Yeah. Maybe you're just like, hey, guys, we should be betting big on Brad Pitt. But the end of the last episode, I said to you, have you seen this? And you said,
what do you think?
And I said, spoiler alert, it's not very good. That was really unfair of me to do that to you, because to call this film not very good is...
It suggests it is within the spectrum of good.
It
implies a quality.
Sure.
Maybe, are we being unfair to this film? We're being very harsh opening. But it is terrible. We watched this film together just now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was finding it very difficult. The premise of the film, extraordinarily simple. And I was finding it very difficult, not just to be invested, but to even attend to what was going on.
Yeah.
We should probably say what the premise is. It was made in 1990, or it was released in 1990. Although Brad Pitt looks, as you were saying while we were watching it, younger than he did in some of the previous films we've seen in Cutting Class, at least. It's Brad Pitt and his brother, and they live in a trailer park with
Brad
their mother.
Brad Pitt plays Joe.
And his brother plays... who's his name is Billy, and I don't remember the name of the actor.
The actor's name is Ricky Schroeder, who's actually first billed in this film. It's Ricky Schroeder... Title card Across the Tracks, Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt still yet to have a top billing. Actually, is he top billed in The Dark Side of the Sun?
He must be.
He's the lead in that film. But Brad Pitt is a... They're both in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad Pitt is a sprinter.
Mm-hmm.
Which... So all the scenes which aim to have some kind of tension in this film involve Brad Pitt running around a track... More slowly than you would expect an actual sprinter to run. Not slowly, but just you're not impressed.
No.
It feels extremely artificial.
It might be one of the most undynamic, unkinetic films I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think
which
that's
is
fair.
A problem for a film about running.
A film with Brad Pitt in it, who is extraordinarily dynamic and kinetic. I mean, those are the things on which he thrives. And it just doesn't take advantage of those.
It does make
features.
Me think, though, like, what? Why is it so hard to make a good sport film?
Yeah,
most films about sports are bad.
That's True, with the exception of Moneyball.
True. Well, because Moneyball, starring really Bradley J. Pitt, there's almost no baseball on screen in that film.
That's true.
The genius of that film is he goes to the final game and you're like, oh, wait, this is what we've been talking about the whole time. Maybe we should just talk about Moneyball for the next...
I would be down for that.
Moneyball is a fucking perfect film.
I've seen that film and I think I... Well, I don't know if... we'll come to that. I really like it.
It fudges the last scene.
Okay. Yeah. I really like Moneyball.
You look desperate to get back to talking about Across the Tracks for some reason, Dan. When, like, my brain is, like, lizard brain flashing in fear, like, talk about anything
I think that's
else.
Also happening to me as well. But I feel like I want to get through Across the Tracks, like a process of mourning. You have to do it at some point.
Sure. Well, you don't, though. It's just entirely self-imposed. There was no reason that we did this to ourselves.
True. The podcast as a whole.
Well, so...
We're not going to go through the plot of Across the Tracks. Well, because this is... For one reason, I don't really remember it.
And this is
maybe
the plot.
30 minutes ago.
Brad Pitt is Joe. He's a runner. His brother is Billy. He's a naughty boy. He tries to steal a car.
Yep. They're both like 18-ish, 17.
Yeah. Billy goes to reform school. He gets out of reform school.
The film opens with Billy stealing the car.
Yeah.
And is then the opening credits or...
Yeah.
And then he's out of reform school.
Yeah. He moves back in with Joe, his brother, and... At first, they don't like each other. Then they start to like each other. Then Joe, who wants to get into Stanford by running track.
Yeah, scholarship.
He wants to get a scholarship. He's, like, really training hard. And then he discovers that his naughty brother, the bad brother, Billy, is an incredibly talented natural runner.
He comes for a run with him. He's very skilled.
Yeah.
As fast. It is said that, wow, you're as fast as me. Although this is the evidence for this in the film is just a long montage of them jogging amongst like vaguely industrial areas in an unspecified
suburban-y.
Yeah,
and then that's the film. That's the third act of the third act of the film is Joe is trying to run this race that will get him into Stanford, and Billy also decides to run the race and. Yeah. Billy could win, but he lets Joe win.
In a practice, he beats Joe. This causes Joe to have like a downward spiral in which he drinks some beer and passes out on some railroad tracks. Why is it called Across the Tracks? Because the running tracks, and also they're on the wrong side of the tracks,
I guess. When we blast through the plot, which we pretty much have to do, there are broader conversations that I want to have, including one about the fact that it's called Across the Tracks. and that's the end of the film. Yeah. The brothers reconcile.
Thanks so much for listening to the Brad Pitt cast.
So here we go. So while I was watching the film, I was thinking of an itemized list of things that I wanted to say to my friend Daniel Dixon.
Okay, wonderful.
The first thing I want to say...
Please.
And I'm sorry, Dan, this is going to be putting you on the spot.
Okay.
We had a conversation the other day. This has got nothing to do with the film at hand, by the way.
I'm nervous.
We had a conversation the other day where you said you didn't think Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island was a good film.
Oh, no.
Now, I think you thought you'd get away with... saying that off mic, but I am here to return you to that call. What the fuck?
Okay, Shutter Island. I've seen that film. I'm pretty sure I've seen that film twice. I definitely saw it at the movies, and I'm sure I watched it again. I can't remember the context in which I watched it again. I think when I saw it at the movies, I had liked it. And then I feel like I read some criticism which kind of turned me around on it, and then watching it again...
I genuinely do not remember.
Was it fucking Brody? It could have been Brody. I was about to say it could have been Richard Brody of the New Yorker. The most
fucking beat up Richard Brody, the fucking dorkiest piece of shit. I hate Richard Brody. He wrote a whole book about fucking Jean-Luc Godard.
He only likes Jean-Luc Godard, and it seems like his entire critical compass is dependent on how close or distant something is to Godard.
What a way to waste your life.
But it's... That film is... Once you know the ending, so slight, I felt. Like, it has so few bones, and it has some fun scares. It's beautiful at times. It is evocative. It has a very strong atmosphere. But once you understand that the atmosphere is, spoiler alert for Shutter Island, entirely contrived...
But that...
Then it, like, maybe it's a comment on the nature of cinema.
Go on, yes!
As in the contrivance of the cinematic space... In relation to...
It's a movie about making a movie.
Okay. I guess it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Ben Kingsley is the director of that film. He's making a movie to prompt an emotional reaction. Is that the dog
Ida is snorting. It may be not being caught by the mic, but she's a recurring character on this podcast.
Dan and I are under the fort again, if you listen to the last episode. I'm just going to quickly poke my head out just to check that she's okay.
I'm sure she is. I think she was just expressing herself.
I think she was just expressing herself. Shutter Island is a movie about making a movie.
But it's also, I think, quite dull. Because everything that feels... And again, it's been some years since I've seen it. But as I remember it, you have this sense of... I feel like when I was young, I watched a lot of serial dramas. The one that comes to mind is Stargate, where clearly... And I don't like those kinds of things anymore, but look, we were all young once.
I've never seen Stargate.
It's fine. Did I mean, it was fine when you were like 9.
Did you know that Stargate the movie was the first film to ever have a website?
It's an interesting fact.
I think I stole that from Blank Check. It's really unfortunate that I listen to one podcast and it's a movie it's a podcast.
Better podcast than ours. One day we'll get close. But yeah, listen to Blank Check, everyone.
Just go on, you watch Stargate.
Stargate, yeah. So, and every episode, it felt like there was... This is my memory of it, at least. Every episode, it felt like we were working towards some big space battle climax. And that is all I wanted in the world, is to see ships shoot lasers at each other in like a real... In like explosive, the stakes are high, everything's going to matter. And always some kind of last-minute diplomatic maneuver like saves us from having to pay for any special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit how Shutter Island felt for me. Okay. There's this
sense
of... What do
you think they're deferring?
I wanted Leo to find the missing person on the island. If you haven't seen Shutter Island, it's going to be just... I'm very simple in my tastes. Okay. I just want a climax and a payoff. I think my mind is also tainted by just having seen Across the Tracks, so I'm now calling the entire concept of cinema into question, which makes it more difficult. Obviously, Shutter Island, an unimpeachably extraordinary work of art in comparison to Across the Tracks, a genuine ceiling of the Sistine Chapel.
I guess my argument is, if you're saying that Shutter Island is it can be boiled down to its twist, I would maybe agree with you if it didn't have the World War II stuff. World War II stuff is a different...
He's got PTSD.
Yeah, because Leo shot the Nazi... Or he let the Nazi officer die who, like, bungled suicide.
That's right.
And it's this one scene that changes the shape of the film for me entirely.
Maybe I've got to rewatch Shutter Island.
I think you do.
It's not sufficiently clear in my mind for me to feel very strongly about it one way or the other. I just remember feeling like it left me a bit cold. Okay. And I think... I think, actually, I'll tell you why partially it left me cold, I think, is because so much of that film is so geared towards the kinds of things that I find very stimulating and exciting in cinema, which is the kind of... It's kind of creepiness, it's uncertainty, the constant fear of the rug being pulled out from under you, the entire world of the movie kind of falling apart around you, which is just... And glimpses of how it might be pulled back together. It's a very emotionally thrilling film. It's not that the twist is predictable necessarily. It's a little bit predictable, but I just wanted more from it. I don't know.
I once met a guy in a bar, and he was... I think I've told you this before. He was a soldier who was deployed in Iraq, and he was back in Australia on like home visit.
Sure.
And we started talking about Shutter Island, and he was convinced that the real twist of the film is that Leo is actually perfectly sane and he's being gaslit by the entire institution.
I mean, I would find that very compelling. I think I like that movie.
Yeah.
In that case. Why did you bring up Shutter Island?
You say some things, Dan, and I love you and I love your opinion, but sometimes you say things that break my heart. One of the things you said was Shutter Island's not a good film.
Okay.
And it was a barb that sunk deep immediately.
I'm willing to change my mind. I'm very changeable. Like, all I need is someone to convince me that something. I mean, I like liking things. This is the other thing. I would love to love Shutter Island because it's one more thing in the world I can love.
That's true.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Well,
so if you could turn me around or not, I'm sure.
The other thing that I think is more pressing that I turn you around on, which is another... This is the fucking airing of grievances, Dan. If you have anything you want to bring up...
You've got me under the fort on the podcast.
You tweeted that you don't think Adam Sandler is a good actor.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I tweeted specifically. And look, I was just kind of trying it out. Follow me, Dan L. Dixon, on Twitter. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, there's no way you found out anywhere else apart from Twitter. Is that Adam Sandler gets a lot of praise specifically because he has set the bar so low.
That is a ridiculous statement, Dan L. Dixon.
Also, the other thing, and I think you need to understand my biography a little bit for this, is that as a child... and this may shock you, I was not especially into the grotesque. And I feel like this might be a place where you and I differ somewhat, but it's in our differences where we find, you know, the energy of this relationship. I think I was Paul Jennings, Goosebumps, Rugrats, these things that were ubiquitous in Ren the 90s. Ren and Stimpy, exactly. You know, all these things I was repulsed by as a child, yet felt were repeatedly thrust upon me. I was kind of titillated by Goosebumps. I was compelled by it, but I still found it vulgar. And I feel like Adam Sandler films were among that category of this kind of things a lot of my peers loved, and you would be at a sleepover and people would be watching, you know, Big Daddy or whatever.
Big Daddy's not so good. Okay. Well, Happy Gilmore.
I saw it again. I probably saw it as like an 8-year-old. And I didn't find them funny. I wanted to watch It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
But which is that's which a throwback to our last episode. I guess I get that.
Seinfeld. I loved Seinfeld.
Goosebumps and Ren and Stimpy are formative for me.
I mean, that makes sense to me.
So an adoration with the grotesque.
I think I like clean lines.
Like
Rugrats, I think, specifically, or even Ren and Stimpy, they are bursting forth messily.
Yeah.
And I think
Rugrats is crass.
Unsettled me.
And I don't...
It is crass. And obviously crassness is implicated in this. But it's not just crassness that upsets me. There's something about a... Round the Twist is another example. I mean, I said Paul Jennings, right?
And that's creeped me out.
And I think I feel like... Obviously there are some differences. But I feel like... And maybe I was wrong. And this is probably an opinion I formed very young. And could, again, be willing to change. But I also think... I love American comedy. I think the best humor in the world is American, generally. But there is something about Adam Sandler films that crystallizes a particular kind of joke that a lot of people I really respect find very funny that I just do not understand.
Still, to this day?
I think so.
Wow.
I'm going to sound like such an asshole.
No,
it doesn't seem clever in any of the ways that I want.
Sure. But
I love slapstick. Like, what? I mean,
yeah.
I love watching a guy slip on a banana.
Do you like Jerry Lewis? Because Jerry Lewis and Adam Sandler are doing the same thing, basically.
I'm not. The only real Jerry Lewis I'm familiar with is King of Comedy, which I love, but that's a different Jerry Lewis, I imagine.
But I think it's interesting you bringing up grotesquery because, like, poor Dan, I have forced Dan to watch, like, many of my favorite films. They're all grotesque. Even something like The Sweet Smell of Success, which is a.
Sure.
Classical film is horrendously grotesque.
The Abject, right? Which again, I'm not, but I think I can find it interesting and I can understand it. The Sweet Smell of Success is grotesque, but it's grotesque in a very considered and intentional and powerful way.
I guess the scene where Sydney is trying to convince the woman to sleep with the columnist.
Oh,
it's like that's brute it's force, also unpleasant. I guess so. What? Because she's willing to do it for him.
Well, it's important to the plot, et cetera, et cetera. It's not for its own sake, I guess is what I mean.
Sure. I just think, I mean, it's something we've talked about a lot of times. I'm sure it will come up because this is a movie podcast and it's something about movies. I am just addicted to the grotesque.
Yeah.
I really think it's the kind of thing that scrambles your brains and sends you a point. I mean, we've talked about this before, but with this film, I wish we were talking about Cutting Class again. We're talking about Across the Tracks. Across the Tracks is a perfect example. So I have something, particularly if you're a first-time listener, which, wild.
Don't, go back, listen to Cutting Class or Ad Astra, even The Dark. Just listen to another episode of this podcast. If we've recorded podcasts, episodes in the future, which I assume we will, go listen to those. That'll be better than this, in terms of the film.
So I have this thing called the werewolf test.
Yeah.
Which is the question of, like, would a movie be improved if one of the characters was revealed in the second act to be a werewolf? This is a prime example of a film that would extremely benefit from grotesquery.
That I agree.
I think it's because my feelings about the grotesque, I've always found the grotesque to be interesting because when someone shows you something grotesque, you have to
react.
You have to say why. Why are they doing this? Whereas, like in the case of beauty, like if someone shows you something beautiful, beauty is always taken as being self-justifying.
Yeah.
You know, if like Moonlight is a perfect example. If I'm watching Moonlight and I'm saying, why is Barry Jenkins making this film look beautiful? That's it's bonkers not, you don't ask question. The question.
Yeah, which that's true. And that's true of all the kind of grandiose emotional or like grandiose aesthetics, right? Or effects. The decision-making process behind those tends not to be as interesting because it justifies itself.
Yeah, because what are you trying to say when you're trying to say something beautiful? Like this, and this film for me feels like more evidence that you should aim for grotesquery, particularly if you have no skills.
But any decision, any different decision in Across the Tracks would be better.
Because it's worth saying that Across the Tracks is... So it was directed by, written and directed by a man called Sandy Tung, who has maybe the craziest filmography of any... I have to quickly pull it up. So, because...
I remember Soccer Dog European Cup, is that
European Cup. He has... So he's made five films and four of them... Six films, sorry.
He wrote and directed this.
Yeah. So Evan's Crime is a film that he made that came out in 2015. So he's still making films. 17 people have logged that on Letterboxd. Mm. So, like, no one's seen that film. So he's made six films. One's Across the Tracks. One's Alice Upside Down, which looks like a Nickelodeon film. And then he made Shiloh 2 and Saving Shiloh, which are films about a beagle. The first Shiloh film is the successful film. So not only was he making films about a dog, he came in late. He did not originate the Shiloh franchise, which, fucking hell, you know? There's that Orson Welles quote, like, don't spend your life making someone else's dreams. It's fucking Shiloh. And then he made Soccer Dog European Cup. So, this man is inscrutable to me. Mm. I think it's worth saying first.
I mean, this actually, Across the Tracks has the feel of a film about animals, in that it would be more interesting if Brad and his brother, Billy and Joey, were animals. It has
That's what, I mean, we've said this before too. Do anything
interesting.
Make them dogs.
Yeah.
Have the script exactly the same and make them a pair of scrapping dogs, one of whom is naughty and goes to the pound.
It would be far
more
interesting.
Why not?
Yeah. This is a film, and I think you said this while we were watching it, where at no point did anyone ask, who am I making this for? The colours are extraordinarily uninteresting, just blindingly uninteresting. It is a film that is the apotheosis of blandness.
Yeah.
Everything about it is bland. It has maybe three or four colours. Most of it is beige. The film is almost exclusively beige. There are no interesting decisions in terms of cinematography.
No.
At all.
So what is going on?
The only interesting editing decisions are that they don't show you things that you expect to see several times that you would quite like to see.
So what is going on set? So there's a lot of people in the crew of this film. Are they all saying to Sandy Tung, the director, are they like, Sandy, let's throw some shadows or a colour gel? Like, are those conversations not happening?
Because it's not... There's no genre choice. Like, it's not even realist.
No.
I think there is a sense in this film, that the energy of this film, its tension, depends entirely on the racing scenes. And everything is like a build-up to the racing scene.
Which are the worst scenes in the film?
They are so dull. And maybe they expected them to come together in editing, and they just do not.
But they don't shoot enough coverage.
Long on them.
It's all in master shots. All of the racing is a wide, just following. There's no inserts. There's no inserts of, like, anything, feet, anything, point of view shots, nothing.
It's just a wide shot of Brad Pitt gradually making his way around a track.
Sure.
With several other students at his school.
And this
with
is
the coach, like, yelling. It'll cut to the coach yelling.
And this is the thing, right, it's that I always talk about, is, like, making interesting decisions. Make them dogs. Or why not make a racing film with no racing scenes in it?
Amazing, yeah.
Cut out the racing scenes from this film.
Yeah, it's a better film.
It's 80 minutes, which I prefer.
It's 96 and it felt like 3 hours.
It's astonishing. Sometimes you see a film and you just go, like, I don't know who made this. I just don't know who the person is. And I don't really know Sandy Tung. He freaks me out.
Well, it's also not a passion project of any kind. Like, the dialogue is repeatedly... so boring and so cliched. They're just playing out tropes around competitive brothers. It's constantly predictable.
Yeah.
There's not a single idea in this film. Mm. I wondered whether it would go the route of, like, some homoeroticism, a la, say, Top Gun, because there's a lot of, like, men
on
tracks.
Do you like Top Gun?
You know, I've never seen it. I've seen a bunch of scenes from it.
I wish I liked that film more. Because I love Tony Scott, the director.
They're rebooting it, right?
They are, with Tom. And Tom Cruise is one of my favourites.
He's a charismatic man.
I was also thinking... So, 2 points. You saying that about Sandy and the choices made me think something that we mentioned while we were watching the film, which is that Brad Pitt does not really work with name directors.
He
almost to this day, he's like real old school Robert Redford style Hollywood filmmaking where you are the star. You are the creative voice in the film. Like he doesn't...
Like Tarantino and the Coens are...
They're eventual.
Yeah.
Before that, he's making star-powered stuff. And when he's doing Tarantino and the Coens, he's the character actor.
Yeah.
He's not the star of either of those films. So what is that? Is it... I mean, at this stage, he's working with Sandy Tung because no one else will hire him. It's not a creative choice. So, but what is it? Is it ego? I want someone who will do what I say. I mean, he makes a couple of films with Robert Redford as a director.
Well, I think you do see, if it is ego, you definitely do see Brad Pitt being extremely Brad Pitt-like in all his films, which suggests that he is getting a fair amount of control over his acting, right? His performance.
No director is telling him, like, Brad.
Because he's doing, and this is something we picked up, and I really, like, there were... six or seven times during this film where he did very typically Brad Pitt gestures that were very striking. And you kind of, I think it was quite a relief to see Brad Pitt come into his own in this
film. He's good in this
film. Which I think he does. He's genuinely good in it. Literally no one else involved in the picture, but he makes a bunch of interesting decisions. But there's this moment where he's on like a public phone and he's kind of clutching at the phone as if he's making out with it and like pressed up against it. And it's very intimate. And there's a lot of, like the way in which you mentioned at one point, he kind of has this gesture of dismissal of someone where he kind of throws his hand above his head, which is typically Brad Pitt. He has a kind of grunt that is a very typical Brad Pitt grunt, which is that he says it either when he's dismissing something or when he's angry.
Yeah.
He does
it a lot in Once Upon a Time.
You start to see all these Brad features come in. And, he is distinctly himself. Yeah. Which might have something to do with his wanting to be able to...
be his own star.
Be his own person on set.
But wouldn't it be boring? That's what I always think. When I think about great performances, they're often, I think, given by actors who are like, to the director, just use me as a marionette puppet. Like, I genuinely think one of the all-time great screen performances is Jack Nicholson in Chinatown. And I don't even love Nicholson.
No, he's a creep.
Although
it can be interesting to be a creep, but he is amazing in that film.
He's famously, Polanski would give him so many line readings. So which is the one thing you're not meant to do, right, is when the director's going like, is literally telling you, say the line in this way. So many people joked that like Polanski was giving Nicholson so many line readings that they expected Nicholson to speak with Polanski's accent in the film. And I love that kind of performance when you want to be molded by your director.
Yeah.
Which is so weird that Pitt never, ever does that. He never seems like he's following...
He's always Brad Pitt. Calls back to an interview around Ad Astra that I think I might have even mentioned in the first episode where he insists that what you're always seeing is Brad Pitt and when you're seeing him be particularly emotional, those are his emotions he's tapping into.
Sure.
So, I mean... A part of the impulse I have throughout this podcast is always to refer to the character he's playing as Brad Pitt.
It's true.
And part of why it's so interesting to see him go on a journey throughout his films is because you're seeing this person.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I've seen quite a few of the films we're going to talk about. I think from here on in, it's Pitt.
Yeah.
You see Pitt in this film, and then this is it. You just see a guy just wandering into the middle of the film.
Which is also just not what actors
are supposed to do. No. But when I was thinking, I was also reflecting the other day, I was thinking, like, who are my favorite actors? Mm. Who are my five favorite actors? Brad Pitt is always obviously one of them, because it would be fucking insane if I was doing this podcast and that wasn't the case. But when I was thinking about my five, would you like to hear my five?
Can I get it?
Go on. Give me one guess, because I don't know if you will get it.
Tom Cruise has to be in there, right?
I don't think top five. I love Cruise. He would be number six.
Interesting. Willem Dafoe?
No, he's the actor who I've seen the most films of.
Hmm.
But I don't necessarily adore... I love Willem Dafoe.
What do you got?
The answers might shock you.
Okay.
So, Brad Pitt... No, I do love Sandler. Brad Pitt. Number two, Richard Burton.
Okay.
I fucking adore.
Sure.
Richard Burton is the first actor I did the completionist thing with and watched every single Richard Burton vehicle. The third one is Clive Owen.
Oh, that is shocking.
I am obsessed with Clive Owen.
He's all... also someone who is maybe always Clive Owen. I haven't seen him in that much stuff, but I've probably seen 4 or 5 of his films.
When I get to the end of the list, you'll notice that that is the 100% the theme. But there's an, I think, a secret theme, but that's what I'm talking. Richard Burton is always Richard Burton. Yeah. Clive Owen is always Clive Owen. Because Clive Owen also has the energy of like a failed leading man, which I always think is fascinating. Yeah. When you watch this film, when you watch this film, you see maybe the failed leading man. You imagine that Brad Pitt's going to be in this kind of film his whole life.
For sure.
Eddie Murphy.
Oh, interesting.
And Eddie Murphy is always Eddie Murphy.
Even in Norbit.
Especially in Norbit. He's always Eddie Murphy, right? That's, don't see
that's definitely true.
Eddie Murphy. And then Peter O'Toole, who's always Peter O'Toole. So what am I attracted to?
Not acting.
Not, I think it's that. I
Which
think
is also maybe
it.
Why you like bad acting.
I adore.
Is because of the sense of, well, what we might describe this as irrepressible authenticity.
That is, damn. There's a reason they pay you the big bucks to write this shit down. It's true. I was also thinking, when I was thinking like secret, also maybe Rock Hudson is tied for the fifth.
I've not seen much Rock Hudson, but I assume...
Yeah.
What I know of him.
Yeah. Well, because... So, when I was thinking about why do I love these people, and this is... It's not meant to be dark, but maybe this is going to sound kind of dark. Mm. Richard Burton was an alcoholic.
Mm.
Hudson was gay and repressed his sexuality. I don't know anything about the life of Clive Owen, but...
Oh, sure. Look, you know what? I hope he's doing well.
Yeah.
I don't imagine he is.
Rough time.
He often looks haggard.
Yeah. People really thought like, oh, Clive Owen's going to be James Bond. He's going to be our next big star. And now you just see him pop up. You're like, what? Clive, man, please.
Yeah.
So all of these people are, whether it's actually something biographical going on in their life.
I feel like Clive Owen's been in like half a dozen films called like Point Alpha with Jennifer Garner, right?
Dan.
Like he just and the poster is like a building that he's about to jump off.
Sure, he was in The International.
That's probably what I'm thinking of. But I feel like that's all he's in nowadays. I mean, look,
he's in Gemini Man, the film that just came out in the cinema. That's like projected to lose like $70 million. But he was in Spike Lee's Inside Man. Have you seen that film?
I have not.
What? What a thing to taste potential success and then for it to sour in your mouth.
Mm.
Like Clive Owen, remember people, if you went up to most people, they would probably know the name Clive Owen because they remember 15 years ago when they were like, hey, this is the guy.
He's one of the stars on the verge of stardom.
Which is, maybe this does go back to why do I love Brad Pitt? Why do I love Clive Owen? Because you're seeing people who exist as personas beyond the screen in ways that influence who they are on the screen.
You can't escape it.
No.
Which is... Yeah.
But what I was going to say is the secret theme of those 5 people is I think all of those people are uncomfortable on camera. you uncomfortable.
I think that's true.
Or they are visibly uncomfortable themselves at times.
Brad Pitt is often performing... He's so consciously performing for the camera... Because of his discomfort that he will be, like, caught out.
Yeah.
Often seems like he's acting to save his life.
If you were in a room with someone who was behaving that way, you would be extremely scared that they knew something terrible that you didn't know.
Yeah, it's like there's a hostage situation and you haven't been told about it yet.
100%. Yeah. Or, like, a nervous toxic gas has been released into the room and he's trying to get you to stay so you breathe enough of it.
Yeah, you'd want a taster. You want to be if he serves you a coffee, you think there's poison in it.
Which is the other crazy thing that we're glancing against anyway, which is like, how does that guy get to be one of the most famous actors in the world?
Pure charisma, right? And also the intensity of his persona.
But I think if you asked most people, do you like actors who are not always convincing you that you're in the movie? They would say no.
Well, it's funny as well, because the person I keep thinking of, two people I keep thinking of, actually, are Michael Cera and Jesse Eisenberg.
Sure.
Because, I mean, obviously, they're similar.
I hate Michael Cera. I really like Jesse Eisenberg, but I hate Cera.
I feel a little unsettled by Eisenberg, and I think he thinks he's smarter than he is. They both write for The New Yorker as well, which is infuriating.
And Eisenberg is a terrible writer.
That is true.
Do you know he's got a book out called Bream Gives Me Hiccups?
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
I agree. Yeah, no.
Is there any facts that you could learn that would as quickly make you think, like, that is a terrible person?
It's I've heard him interviewed. He's
kind of fun in interviews though, because he's extremely rude. He's
so arrogant.
It's but weird. Look, the
reason I think about those two men is because people complain about them always playing the same character.
Mm-hmm.
However, I wouldn't put them in the same category as your faves, because I feel like there's kind of an intensity of inhabiting a persona. Sure. That they are occupying. And I don't have a problem with actors playing the same type of person again and again. You get hired because you're particularly good at a particular kind of skill, a particular kind of acting, and that makes sense. It seems like something different is going on with someone like Brad Pitt.
Well,
he's not playing into a particular persona again and again. No matter what he's tasked with doing, he somehow manages to bring himself into it.
But also I think sometimes with, like, Sarah and Eisenberg... awkward. I mean, Eisenberg's a dickhead, right? And Sarah is your awkward, like, basically sexless boyfriend.
Yeah.
I think what makes them less interesting to me is the films that they're in always know that.
And that's true.
With the actors that I listed, there's always a metatextual break between who they actually are and who the film treats them as.
That's important, especially with what you like in film, right? Is this sense of the film not quite having a grasp of itself. Like, the film's kind of getting away from the film as it's being made.
Yeah, chaos.
Which, and the only element of that in Across the Tracks is Brad Pitt. This is a film that, in a way, is entirely in control because it's so boring. It's not trying to do anything that could allow it to get out of its own control. It's just not making any decisions which could, like, go in a wrong direction.
Yeah.
But Brad Pitt is doing his best to kind of make things slightly weird.
He's chafing against the film.
Mm.
He wants to go somewhere that the film is not letting him go. And I think eventually Pitt will get so good at what he does, he breaks away from the film entirely, leaves the film behind. Here, he's not quite ready to do that.
There's a series of interesting moments in Across the Tracks because he is struggling to achieve as much as he wants to on the track. He's being beaten by some runners. His brother is better than him and he's getting mad. And it's... the film unintentionally kind of replicates the tension of Brad Pitt in the film.
You said this when we were watching it. It's a great thesis.
Being mad about not being as good a runner as he is. He wants to get into Stanford. That's why he's running, so he can get a Stanford scholarship, as Joe said. And this enthusiasm for running that Brad Pitt brings to the table, you feel that he also has that equal... Brad Pitt himself has that enthusiasm for acting.
Yeah.
As he's kind of pressing into this role, 100%. Being given nothing by any of his peers.
No.
And he's bouncing off the scenery. He's yelling emphatically. He's moving... the energy in his body... Ironically, the only time he does not have energy in his body really is when he's running. Occasionally, there are a couple of scenes where he seems...
well, it's clearly body doubles for at least some of the running stuff.
Definitely true. Yeah, there's some just real... yeah. Distant. This film is shot from a distance.
Yeah.
Very few close-ups.
Clearly very cheap.
Yeah.
It does. So, another thing that I was thinking of when we were watching the film that I wanted to bring up, and this is a good time... so this film clearly has...
I hated this film.
Dan!
I've had a rough week.
Dan was staring off into space.
I've had a lot on. And man, I hated this film.
Do you think it's the worst film you've ever seen?
It's a very good question. So last week on Cutting Class, we were talking about films being cruel.
Yeah.
Or maybe we were even talking about this in The Dark Side of the Sun as well. The Dark Side of the Sun was not a cruel film. It was an incompetent film. This film verges on the cruel because of the way in which the brother... there's a few scenes where he gets into drugs and he's got this kind of guy who's...
the naughty brother, Billy.
Yeah, the naughty
brother. I love calling him naughty as well. Neuters the effect of the film.
But it's also kind of coherent in the world of the film. Like, that's the problem is his naughtiness. That would be how the film would almost describe it. He gets into drugs. He has this guy who's a bad influence who tries to make him deal drugs. He's on parole, so if he gets into trouble... He will be going back to reform school or whatever. And the brother's like... the film presents him as a nice guy, but the cruelty of the people around him is unnecessary. And the film is so wrapped up in his kind of descent and possible redemption in a really gratuitous way. I don't know if I can describe it any more fluently than that. Just because the film's so incompetent, it's hard to even get a grip on.
Do you think it's cruel, though?
I don't know. It's
exploitative, maybe. But this is the thing, right? The exploitation is... so
it's probably not the worst film I've ever seen. I'm sure I've seen worse films. It might genuinely be the most boring film I've ever sat through, because in any other circumstance...
you just switch it off.
I'd switch it off, and if I was with someone and they wanted to watch this, I would reconsider the friendship.
If someone said, I'm invested, you would be like, this is maybe a robot.
Yeah.
Or this person has had a massive... they're currently having a stroke.
Yeah. It's I would call an ambulance.
What is the shorthand you have for the worst film ever made then? Do people seem... I was going to say...
But like...
What the hell?
No. Don't do this to me. The Room's making interesting decisions. I've watched it like 4 or 5 times, obviously.
The Room is a great film.
I think this is returning to our question of intentionality or like at least artistic complexity being involved in evaluation.
I don't even think The Room is badly made. I think if you released The Room and you said the director was David Lynch...
I saw Snow Dogs at the cinema when I was little and not enjoying that. A Cuba Gooding Jr. maybe?
I used to say my least favourite film was Red State, the Kevin Smith film.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a film that... I mean, Smith in general might be one of my least favourite filmmakers. Kevin that. Smith and Lav Diaz are like the two worst filmmakers.
I remember not hating Clerks, but it's a wild
film. I fucking hate
Smith
thinks he's much cleverer than you are.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true.
He thinks he's zany and cool and funny, and he's a fucking prick. He's such a prick. His films are so bad.
I'm still trying to think of the worst film. Anyway, I probably won't get there, but it might come up later. Smith, I really don't like Kevin Smith.
Yeah, he's...
You've seen the picture of him with his big jorts getting petrol.
And the tweet?
I don't even want to talk about it.
The single
worst
tweet.
If you know it,
tweet.
And if you haven't, you don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, you really don't want to hear about it. What was I going to say? Exploitation, right? So one thing that I was thinking when I was watching this film is something that we kind of haven't talked about this film is this film thinks it kind of has a social message. This film is very scared of drugs.
Is that the Across the Tracks? Yeah, it is scared of drugs.
And it glances in the worst possible way against race.
This film is problematic, to say the least.
Pitt and his brother live in a trailer, and there are lots of African-American people around them in what you could probably generously describe as set dressing.
Yeah.
They are not characters in this film. They are there to suggest towards the idea that they live in a slum, basically.
They move the plot along. There's this really strange scene. The coach is African-American, and towards the end, he's trying to convince Brad Pitt to run, because Brad Pitt is so upset by the fact that he's been bitten by his brother in the lead-up that he's kind of thinking of quitting the track team. And the coach says... You have the chance to be better than I was or something. Yeah. And this is the first gesture we've had to this person having
this is the last
any
15
kind of history.
Minutes of the
we've
film.
Seen him like yelling before encouragement. And so there's this weird whiff of a backstory that is only used to kind of shift the plot in a particular direction. And no attention is paid at all to the character.
It's
and
the first time like that an African-American character in the film has... any gesture towards an interior life.
Because there's also the principal is African American and she just...
She just is there to make life trouble for Billy, the naughty kid.
She just threatens Billy with going back to reform school and just, again, no... even saying no depth feels generous. There's
generous to the concept of shallowness.
Exactly. She's a function.
So this film glances against social issues. It is not kind of nominally anti-drug. There's lots of paranoia about the fact that these kids are smoking
like
pot.
Like a PSA.
Yeah, which is what I want to get to. Right.
Okay.
And this is a broader conversation that we obviously have to be careful with, because I have to be careful with. And Dan's face is one of, like, quiet horror. He's quite worried about what I'm
going
to say.
This
film wants to be socially instructive. It wants to teach you good values.
Mm.
I think... increasingly these days, some mainstream critics have that attitude about cinema, that it should be socially instructive in a good way. Everyone's got extremely upset about Joker, for instance, in the idea...
Which neither of us have seen.
Which people seem to think that that film is dangerous because it's inciting bad moral lessons.
Yeah.
Disgust.
It was like, another example of that would be Wolf of Wall Street, which is a film I know both you and I like, because it clearly... is not... It also, it could be endorsing Jordan Belfort's lifestyle, and that would be fine. Yeah. It's clearly not doing that.
Well, I guess that's my question is, do you think that film needs to have a socially important message? Do you mean it needs to uplift people?
No.
But what about the opposite? Do you think that films that promote unhealthy attitudes are toxic, bad for people?
It depends. I mean, it's a complicated... I think part of the problem is you can't reduce art to an essence, right? So you can't then... You cannot... One would be within one's rights to evaluate, say, Wolf of Wall Street or Joker exclusively on its political terms as if it were a vehicle for a social message. But to presume that that is the exclusive criteria for the film is just not how art works.
Sure.
I absolutely think you can't. You can talk about those implications of a film, but you can't judge a film exclusively artistically on those values.
And I think I have an opinion which I know is probably unpopular and is again probably something that's the result
fourth
of watching
episode, Joe.
Are you worried about me getting cancelled?
I mean, both of us.
Sometimes I am more interested in a film that has a deviant social message.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of my preference, if I would rank the preference in terms of social messaging, number one is no direct social message. Number two is a social message I don't agree with. And number three is a social message I do agree with.
I will say there is nothing I like less than a comedian whose primary function is applause lines. Mm-hmm. And I think it's what... I cannot think of a comedian that makes me angrier than Trevor Noah, who is deeply unfunny.
Yeah.
And it's the same...
He's also very problematic. Like, he's made incredibly racist.
Yeah, he has made incredibly racist remarks that also seem kind of concomitant with his worldview as well in some pretty upsetting ways. But Jon Stewart, I felt the same way about towards... I used to love The Daily Show, and then towards the end it just started to become an engine for applause.
Sure.
And I feel like that's just... it's a thing, but it's uninteresting. It's like a TED Talk.
Sure.
And a TED Talk is not a work of art.
Sure. And I should clarify, too, I'm not saying that I wish going forward that more people would make films with noxious social messaging.
Yeah, I also, yeah.
I just think of the social messaging in the world. There is nothing that upsets me more than a film that is trying to convince me that it's going to make me a good person, particularly when the film is saying something that I agree with. Because our good friend, Eleanor Gordon Smith...
Oh, yeah. Drag her into this.
She wrote an entire book about the idea that you can't change people's minds.
In the ways we might expect to, through, like, traditional methods of persuasion.
Does art change people's minds? Does anybody watch Across the Tracks who is, like, a deviant drug user and then decide to clean up their act and run in a track race?
I mean, I guess a different question would be, if this was a good film, would it be more likely to change people's minds? I think that... I don't think you can make any hard and fast rules about any of this. I think that's the thing. I think if a film has a social message, it should not be the essence of the film. It should not be primarily a vehicle for that. A film can have a social message incidentally. That is interesting. And I don't think we have to think about the moral quality of an artistic object based on whether it can change people's minds or not. I think that might be a different question as well.
That's a good point. And I'm aware that I'm quite hypocritical on this. So, for example, like, an issue that I care about very deeply is animal rights and the environmental rights. And one of my favorite filmmakers is a guy called Larry Fessenden, who almost exclusively makes films that are pro-environment and are extremely heavy-handed. And I interviewed him, and he was like, listen, someone's going to stick up for the little guy. And I approve of that. But for some reason, I don't necessarily approve when it's saying, like, don't do drugs, don't do crime. I want films that say, do crime, even though I don't think people should do crime.
Like Joker, maybe, from which either is obscene. I think that's all fair enough.
I feel like I'm pulling your teeth down.
No, sorry. I think this is a worthwhile conversation, and it's also interesting in terms of Across the Tracks, because what takes this film from bad to... or from boring to dismal is its attempt at a social message, or like clumsy or heavy-handed, right? I think those are the problems. It's when you sacrifice the quality of the art. It's when the form has no relation to the content as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you need some coherence, like artistic coherence around how you're delivering your message, at least. And I think it's quite hard to do that when you've got a clear political message.
Sure.
I don't want... Obviously, there are a range of issues with this kind of conversation, right? It's like, well, how do you define politics? How do you define social messages?
Sure.
At what point might we take a film to be endorsing its content or not? And does that matter as well? Like, if something is conveyed incidentally, what is the artistic moral responsibility for something that has not been intended? Again, Wolf of Wall Street is a good example, right? A bunch of bros have Jordan Belfort memes on their, like, Facebook pages called Business Boss.
Yeah.
And that sucks. But it's not Martin Scorsese's fault.
Yeah. And it's definitely true that, like, I guess, and this goes to my point that, like, I wouldn't encourage anyone to make a film with a noxious social message. I do think that, like, you know, there is a sense in which, like, we live in really bad times that are getting way worse for a lot of people. And literally anything that we can do to stop worse times is something that we should try to do. So sometimes I think if there are films that maybe would be taken the right way by 10 people, but taken the extremely wrong way by 400 people, we should maybe ultimately not make
those films. You have to be pragmatist about those things to some degree.
Sure.
Like, it seems practically bad if a bunch of, you know, if a bunch of people were to become jokers.
Yeah.
That seemed, but I mean, Todd Phillips seems like a moron anyway.
Phillips is
the director of The Joker.
Moron. I called him a Mormon. He's definitely not a Mormon. He definitely is a moron.
It's a complicated question to talk about generally, right? Yeah. Outside of specifics. But I think one thing we can say for sure is Across the Tracks certainly suffers for not having a social message. For having a social message, rather. And Cutting Class certainly benefits for not having an intentional social message.
Sure.
One of the wonderful things about that film is its social nihilism.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
it's so appealing. And we should, you know, it's nice to be able to just enjoy something. That film is absolutely not free of politics.
No.
And that's fine. Like, nothing is free of politics.
Exactly.
Well, but its intention is one of entertainment.
Sure.
And that's what it's reducible to.
Sure.
And that's far more interesting. And it's far more interesting to understand politics as something that happens incidentally.
Sure.
In that context. And, like, a thing that I care about is a film's or a work of art's generosity to its audience. And to allow your politics to be incidental rather than super intentional and deliberate is a generous move.
Sure. Well, yeah, I guess it makes me think. Watching Across the Tracks made me think a lot, which is a film that has broad social messages that I agree with, that, like, everyone should try and improve themselves and don't beat people up.
Yeah.
Like, don't be... I agree with all those things. But, like, a film that I adore... So if Across the Tracks is a half-a-star film, a film that I adore is a film called If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do? Do you know this film?
I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
Sure. That film is a recording of a sermon by a priest called Estes Perkel.
Okay.
Intercut with filmed recreations of the things that Perkel is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And Perkel thinks that communism will lead to the destruction of the United States, that people will be shot and killed, that Fidel Castro will be taught in schools. It's an astonishing film. So what I mean when I say that sometimes I prefer a film with a message that I don't agree with,
yeah,
I don't think any of those things are true about communism, but I see someone else's mind, and the mind is so committed. I really believe that Estes Perkel thought that communism would lead to the downfall of the United States. I don't even believe that Sandy Tung thinks that marijuana is bad.
No,
I don't. Definitely not. I think often when people are trying to impart quote-unquote good social messaging, because it's the messaging broadly of the time and the communities in which they live, they're just taking on attitudes that they don't necessarily believe in.
That's extremely true. There's also the question of what kind of mind would you like an insight into, right? And if that's the film we're to ask about art, then, like, fucking love Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah.
And that's this, right? Like, I'm much more interested in the mind of Hieronymus Bosch than in the mind of, say, like, Rubens.
Yeah.
Who just is just painting, you know, chubby angels.
Yeah.
I want to see hell and purgatory and it's in its most absurd formations.
But then why don't you like Rugrats? Isn't that what we're talking about?
I think...
Do you think that's changed over time?
It's a good question, and I don't think it has changed over time. I think I really don't know.
Okay.
It might have something to do with my sense that Rugrats is not taken as seriously as I want it to be by its creators.
Sure.
It's kind of just messing with me. Whereas Hieronymus Bosch, I like being messed with.
Okay.
Maybe within certain... I would have to think more deliberately about what kind of messing I like and what kind I don't. I don't like to feel unsteady on my feet. I like to know where I am in relation to a work of art, I think.
Sure. Maybe that's because of the different way. I mean, we're both critics, but I guess your style of writing is, I think, to your credit as a writer, you're often more reflective of contextual and cultural values in terms of writing. Maybe you want to be standing still and you're furrowing your brow. Is that right?
I think that's true. I like that. I'm also thinking about how maybe the reason I don't like Shutter Island is because and not just because of its twist, but its twist so comprehensively moves me from where I thought I was standing in relation to the film. Even when I'm predicting the twist, I'm kind of disappointed that that's all there is.
Sure.
And I also actually think to go back to Shutter Island, on the question of the World War II stuff, that felt pat and cliched to me. Like, it feels like World War II trauma is, I've seen it a lot, and to have it played out in a film where it didn't seem to make, I felt like it wasn't earned. And I think there's this sense of slight trivializing of a number of things going on in that film that mean that where I want to stand in relation to its serious themes is just constantly being undermined. I do not know if I'm making any sense.
No, I understand what you mean. I think on the question of it being pat, I think what I like about the flashback is something that I don't often see, which, like, the significant thing about that flashback is a Nazi officer has tried to commit suicide. He's blown off his jaw and he's lying on the floor bubbling out. He's reaching for the gun to properly finish himself, and all DiCaprio does is kick the gun out of his way. And what that is unusual, I think, is that that shows that DiCaprio's character knows that there are worse things than death. Suffering is worse than death. Usually when you have World War II flashbacks, the character is upset about having killed someone.
Yeah.
DiCaprio is haunted by not having killed someone. And the understanding that there are worse things than death then becomes literalized for him. And it's like the psychological torment that will never leave him alone.
That's a very compelling take. I believe it.
On a much better film. You know something? That, you know, talking about hot takes, you know a hot take I have?
Please.
Martin Scorsese, talented filmmaker.
He's good.
Good filmmaker.
That's what he's doing.
Do you know, sometimes I genuinely think, how fucking long? We can wrap up real soon, but...
It's almost an hour. We can, you know.
But don't you think sometimes...
Cross the tracks to talk about.
In literature and cinema, being canonized can be a really bad thing.
Definitely.
Like,
yeah, it dries you out.
If someone said to me Apocalypse Now was their favorite film, I think I'd kind of be like, oh.
Be more interesting.
But Apocalypse Now is a perfect film. Yeah. Of course it's a 5-star film.
Yeah.
Same with Martin Scorsese. If you get real excited, I think sometimes it's where there's sometimes an exhaustion with filmmakers like Scorsese that come just from the fact that they're
oversaturating
in the culture. Yeah. But how do you avoid that as a filmmaker?
You'd be less good, I guess. Be weirder.
Yeah.
Right.
But Scorsese is so fucking weird. He can
be very weird. Yeah.
Last Temptation of Christ is such a bizarre film. Willem Dafoe. Blame Jesus. Before we wrap up, tell me another actor that you love. Because I got to list my 5 favorites. Tell me another one you love, and we'll see if it relates to some kind of pathology with Brad Pitt.
Okay, Jimmy Stewart.
I like Jimmy Stewart a lot.
Yeah, who also is someone who cannot be contained by his roles.
Stewart is wild.
He's so crazy.
He's doing a caricature of himself.
I don't know if he's good. The reason he came to mind is because I was trying to think of someone who I am just always thrilled to be watching on screen, both because I don't know what will happen next, and I know with such certainty what will happen next, which is that he'll be Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. He also, Jimmy Stewart, you have to carefully use him, though, because you could not...
You could really ruin some quiet movies with
He could
Jimmy
not
Stewart.
Be in a film about, like, a concentration camp. You would parodize whatever. Is that a word? You would turn any subject that you want into parody with the inclusion of Jimmy Stewart.
But if anything is slightly camp, he'll be an absolute delight.
Yeah. He's you know what? Another hot take, Dan. Vertigo. It's a pretty good film.
Yeah, one of the best.
Do you know something else? The thing that Slavoj Žižek said about, like...
San Francisco?
Yeah, San Francisco was created so it could be filmed in Vertigo.
I've been there and I believe that.
A correct thing to say.
Yeah, really.
I'm spitting off all these fucking hot takes right now. What more do I have? Sigmund Freud?
No, I actually think Freud was good as well, but this might get a
change the culture.
He did. Oh, he transformative.
Yeah,
paved the way for a lot of really wonderful thinking.
What else is there? Any extremely uncontroversial opinions you have? Claire Denis, great filmmaker. Werner Herzog,
The Godfather,
great filmmaker. Godfather's
it's
a great
actually a really
film.
Good movie.
Star Wars movies are really good.
No, yeah, all the good ones are good and the bad ones are bad. You know.
What else? Go on, keep it coming. Infinite Jest, monumental book.
It's a
book.
Solid book. Middlemarch is genuinely one of maybe the best book of all time.
Yeah. Jane Austen knew her shit.
I think she's the funniest.
Emily Bronte knew her shit. Wuthering Heights.
Charles
really
Dickens
good.
Is like hilarious and constantly
extraordinary.
Dickens read some Dickens. David Copperfield, Tolstoy knew what he was doing.
Tolstoy, 100% on it. Dostoevsky, smart guy.
Fantastic. Understood the human condition. Really? Rare insight.
Come on, keep it
Across
going.
Across the Tracks is a shit film.
Yeah, it is. What are the unquestionably shit films then? Oh, see, you can't... Isn't that interesting? I can't say anything that I think is uncontroversially... La La Land is a terrible film, I think.
Almost won the Oscar.
Very unpopular.
I haven't seen La La Land.
You know, I'm an Oscars junkie. Yeah. This house really sounds like the fucking house is on fire. Yeah, if you can hear footsteps running around, we're under a rug, so the house might generally be on fire.
We wouldn't know.
We wouldn't know.
Is there a smoke alarm?
Yes. I hope so.
Me too.
I was a real Oscars junkie, and nothing has ever replicated the highs of the La La Land year for me, because I hated that film so much, and it lost in the best possible way.
Yeah.
It didn't just lose, it was wrenched from...
I mean, we speak about actors who almost taste success and then have it dragged away from them.
Sure.
That was...
it was beautiful. Also...
I remember I was live streaming it. I was
live
meant to be working at a job I no longer have, and I had... minimized the window, so I was just listening to the feed. I was like, well, something's happening.
Yeah. Twitter exploded. Yeah, it was one of those moments where, like, make up for the fact that Twitter is a hellscape, like, hooked to our veins.
Yeah.
It was a transcendent moment.
It genuinely was.
Speaking of actors who do things that make you really like them, do you remember Ryan Gosling's response? He was on stage.
No, I don't actually.
And he was just smirking in, like,
great.
The best way.
Yeah.
And people asked him afterwards, and he was like, he could see, like, the mounting, like, people running, and he could see, like, the PAs and the producers, and he thought something awful had happened.
Oh, okay.
And so when it just turned out that his film hadn't won...
What a relief.
He was like, this is kind
of
funny.
He seems like a nice guy.
I like Ryan Gosling. Uncontroversial opinions, Ryan Gosling.
Excellent actor. Consistent.
He would be an interesting person to do a series like this for.
Yeah. Gosling cast.
Sometimes, I mean, we're right at the beginning of our Brad Pitt journey,
yeah.
Which is exciting. I'm really excited. There are so many good films.
This has to be the most unwatchable Brad Pitt experience, right?
Sure.
This is... I don't know if we've made this clear. This is... I feel like the way we talked about The Dark Side of the Sun was it so bad it's good, maybe worth trying. And I would, like, watch a scene or two of The Dark Side of the Sun to get a sense of it.
It's reduced nicely in my memory.
Yeah,
I can kind of think back
images.
Fondly on it.
Across the Tracks... absolutely no reason to watch a single second of it.
No.
It is TV movie level that, like, never made it to TV.
So can I read you, maybe as our final step, I want to read you the reviews on Letterboxd of people who think that this is a good film.
I would love to hear them.
I can also tell you further details. So this is a person called...
Email these people and ask if they're okay.
This is a person called Hannah, who gave the film only 2.5 stars.
It's too many. 2.5 too many.
This wasn't as bad as it could have been.
That's also true about some forms of torture.
And you know what? I'm going to say Brad was cute AF.
That's true.
It's something
that
is actually...
true. Whether that he's 2.5 stars cute AF is, I think, a different question.
It's something that I realized listening back to the podcast. We have been unfair. We haven't talked about the fact that... we said that Brad Pitt was beautiful. He's an extremely sexually attractive and potent
man. His hair in this is incredible. The way he moves is extraordinary.
He's not beautiful like a picture. He is
he's present.
Hot
he's,
and attractive.
Yeah.
That, which he's is another uncontroversial opinion.
Brad Pitt is an attractive man. He's embodied in his attractiveness, I think, which is interesting. Unlike a lot of movie stars who look best on the poster.
Exactly.
Brad Pitt looks best when he's moving.
100% true. This is Doug. 3 stars. Really enjoyed it.
What?
Perfect encapsulation of the time period.
That's...
I don't know what the fuck that means.
What is that?
2 great lead performances. Pitt is great. Ricky Schroeder is not good. This is my favorite line. Uplifting story of redemption and family. I guess.
I suppose so.
I guess.
Both boys are redeemed somewhat.
And then he has a little kicker at the end here.
Uh-huh.
Perfectly enjoyable. If unspectacular.
It's certainly unspectacular. It is not perfectly enjoyable. It is extremely... It should put you to sleep. It should make you unplug the television.
Yeah. Another perfect one. So this is a Letterboxd account called Marijuana Movies, which appears to just rank films based on the pot in them. So the review
is... it's a hell of a subculture.
The review is Bad Boy Billy and Louie burn one in the opening scene after stealing a car. Later, after prison reform, Louis offers Billy a bong hit at his coming home from prison party. This is quite well written. So, like, coming home from prison party, they have hyphens.
That's nice, given that they might be permanently stoned if they're running a marijuana-centric account. That's surprising.
Because Louis is making $1,000 a week dealing, which is true,
mm-hmm.
he offers Billy a job and sends him a box of miscellaneous drugs to sell. Billy brings the box back and questions Louis's motive. He tells him he can sell rock, coke, pot. Billy turns down the job offer. So if you're following marijuana movies, are you just so hungry for pot representation that you're like... And they've only ranked 1,141
it's
films.
It's like those websites that exclusively document sex scenes.
Or feet. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's also interesting because it serves two functions. One would be to... You should follow that if you're a mother concerned for what your child is being exposed to, and avoid those films, or at least skip those scenes.
Okay, another... So this is Wake Up Brit, who is not sold on the film, necessarily. They do have the craziest top four favourite films on Letterboxd I've ever seen.
Read them out.
I'm not making fun of this person. I love it when I see someone who, like...
Yeah, distinctive.
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Okay.
I forgot that film
ever existed. I thought that film disappeared from public consciousness.
The Breakfast Club, I don't necessarily like that film.
But I understand it's his favourite.
Jaws is a chaos pick in terms of these other choices. Ocean's 11.
Uh-huh.
So a Brad Pitt
There's no logic to those four films.
No, which I love.
Yeah.
I'm genuinely not being
the
mean.
The Breakfast Club and Ocean's 11.
That's great. And actually, Wake Up Brit's review is on the money, basically what we've said. This movie, well, okay, I lied because the first sentence is not what we've said at all. This movie is shockingly heartwarming and has lots of real moments between its characters.
Real moments, not fake moments.
I disagree. Yeah. Unfortunately, those real moments are overshadowed by all of the overacting and clunky dialogue that fills most of the screen time. I don't think they're talking about Pitt because, to be fair, it is an after-school special and didn't want or need to be much more. This person has been much reasonable than we've been for the last hour. Bradley Pitt gives a solid performance and is definitely the main reason to watch. Basically,
I agree
what we said. There's
but there aren't real moments. There's no real moments.
No, I guess I was going to try and be
charitable.
I am
struggling with this film. Maybe you can tell.
This is also insane review by someone called Eddie Mulligan, who has really good top four favorite films: American Graffiti, great film; Last Picture Show, great film; Mean Streets, great film; Once Upon a Time in the West, great film.
Sure.
Their review: just because Brad Pitt's and Ricky Schroeder's dad kicked the bucket and took along his angelic baby boy making testicles with him doesn't mean that these two troubled teens should have to live across the tracks. You'd think if their widowed mother just got her hands on a JCPenney's catalogue that she'd realise the gold mine she was sitting on and thrust her two beautiful boys into the high fashion world. But definitely true.
Among the most fascinating genres of writing is the amateur film reviewer who feels they have a strong voice.
But they're spending
their time on it.
I love
editing.
Editing.
They're taking a few passes.
We've only got a couple more.
I want to hear them all.
This person, Jesper Lundstedt, has written it in Swedish, so I can't tell you what they think. Their four favourite films, real good. Chungking Express, Grave of the Fireflies, Columbus, and Neon Genesis Evangelion. Well, pretty good. Is that it? There was one... A lot of four and a half stars.
That's
reviews
crazy.
Here.
Crazy. Genuinely, if you've never seen cinema before, maybe you've only seen silent films and you're just shocked. Because also, that's something we didn't mention, the sound design is crazy.
The sound design
in the running
is
scenes,
insane.
It feels like the Foley was made with someone like shuffling slippers in a sandpit.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. It's grating. The mixing is weird, so the vocals are often covered up by the pitter-patter of running feet.
Yeah.
Everything about this film...
Yeah, is a mess.
Is a total mess.
This is the last review, and it's a beautiful place for the last review to leave it. A very young Brad Pitt runs and runs in this sports drama.
Yeah, thank you. Now I know
it's William Carlos Williams.
It is William Carlos Williams.
I ate the plums. Beautiful.
But it doesn't... Does that tell you whether you should see it? I guess if you want to see a young Brad Pitt run and run, you should see this film. Well, no, there's other films to watch Brad Pitt run and run in.
That's true. Although, he runs a lot in this film. This is a heavy running film.
Maybe a solid 20% of this is... We didn't mention the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like... 80s, extremely dramatic, incongruous 80s music.
Pan flutes.
Yeah.
Done by Joey Goldsmith, who is Jerry Goldsmith's son. One of the six children of Jerry Goldsmith, who is like one of the most famous composers in the entire world.
I mean, it's a real fall from glory. It's a plunge.
Which is Sandy Tung's fault. Sorry, yeah. Sandy. If you're listening to this podcast, Sandy, you should have said to Joey Goldsmith, give this another
Take
try.
Another shot.
You should have at the least said that.
As Brad Pitt did in his running.
So
in the final scene,
is this the worst film?
Finally beats his brother.
Is this the first worst film we've covered? Is this worse than The Dark Side of the Sun?
I mean, for a given value of worst, it is. I had a worse time watching this film. I wanted it to end desperately, and it felt. We were checking the time, like 45 minutes in, halfway ish through, and it felt impossible.
Yeah.
It felt like it had been going for so long. It distended time in some pretty magical ways. So I would. This is definitely the... I hope I do not have a less enjoyable viewing experience in the course of this podcast. And I hope we did not take the energy from that film viewing into this podcast.
I am worried that we have worse films. I have seen some of the films coming up. I've seen A River Runs Through It.
Okay.
I hated it.
Yeah, well... It's got at least... But it has to be shinier than this, right? This film is ditch water.
Yeah.
It has to at least have some decisions.
Yeah. Is this... this is maybe an opportune time. I think Brianna Elton has just walked in. Brianna, is that you?
Hello.
Do you want to be on the podcast?
Come here for a second.
Just say hi. Preview the next.
So next week we're going to be talking about Thelma and Louise with Ridley Scott. In order to help us discuss that film, she's coming under the fort now.
She's crawling in.
Wow. Here she is. This is my partner, Brianna Elton.
Hello.
How you doing?
Hey, Brianna.
This fort is intimate.
It is intimate. Yeah, I don't think we'll be able to fit all three of us in next week. We'll have to work out another setup.
Because I was thinking we want to ask some, like, fairly prestigious... Not prestigious. We want to ask people who we don't personally know.
At some point, we want guests
on this
podcast.
You just want Brad Pitt in this pillow fort.
That's true, ultimately.
This pillow fort gets very musky, though. It would not be the best way to show off our angle to Brad Pitt.
No,
yeah.
What do you think he smells like?
You know what?
I bet he smells like... Well, because he used to smoke a lot of pot. Go on, sorry, Dan.
I don't think he smells great. Like, I don't think he smells bad, but I think he's got a musk about him. I mean, you've seen the hat he wears these days.
All right, my glasses are fobbing up. I'm going to get out of here.
No, Brianna, just quickly tell us that you'll be here next week.
Will I?
Yeah, because we're doing fucking Thelma and Louise.
Okay.
Are you excited about that?
Sure.
Have you listened to this podcast yet?
She has now.
See you, Brianna.
Bye. Good to see you.
You
too.
Yeah, Brianna's going to talk about Thelma and Louise, and she hasn't seen it yet.
Neither have I.
You haven't seen it yet. I really don't like Thelma and Louise.
Do you think I might like it?
I really don't know.
Okay. Well, that's better than being certain that I won't.
It's true. It's true.
It's a beloved film, right?
Maybe I'm hoping that. So this, I'm sure we'll relitigate this next episode. But
no doubt.
My favorite director when I was about 12 years old was Ridley Scott, which is insane.
Yeah.
And I went through and I watched every film Ridley Scott had ever made, because I've always been this kind of terrible person.
Mm.
And I really didn't like Thelma and Louise, and I haven't seen it since. So I haven't seen it in 16 years.
Okay. Has your taste remained unmoved in that time?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Which is terrible. It's really bad
to admit as a cultural critic. You've kept a pure essence, I guess you could put it that way.
But sometimes it's bad to be the same person your whole life.
But not in every way.
I guess not. I think I'm pretty much the same as I was 12 years old. I'm as anxious. I've had arthritis in my right knee since I was about 11 years old.
I think... Yeah, well, we'll find out. I mean, that can be the teaser, right, for next week. We'll find out if Joe is still 12-year-old Joe and hates Thelma and Louise.
As a final sting, we're about to watch Watchmen.
Yeah, the first episode of the HBO series.
Maybe it could be a hidden... Because we're doing it every week and Watchmen drops every week. Maybe at the end of each episode we can be like, hey, last week's episode of Watchmen.
This can become a Watchmen recap podcast for the more boring episodes.
Secretly. I really like that Watchmen comic book.
I don't remember. I am not in the thrall of comics in the same way that you are. I remember thinking it was fine and interesting.
Sure.
I think I also, and maybe this can be something we talk about at some point, don't know if I know how to read comics. I get confused.
Really?
I have enjoyed some comics, but I do not know if I understand how to absorb their narrative, how to appreciate the art, how to kind of... I think timing in particular, I'm not sure how to time it. Like a book manages its its temporality in very clear ways for me, a novel and a film, obviously, as well. I think the level of control I have in a comic kind of unsettles me.
Wow.
Because I just speed through it.
But you can do that.
I think this is, again, there might be a way in which this shouts back to the Casablanca discussion from last week, in which I feel like, and even our highbrow, lowbrow dynamic, right, in which you collapse those distinctions, I am confused about the degree to which I am meant to appreciate something if it's too easy. There might be something about that.
That's very interesting.
And it's not that I am just snobbish about it. It's like I don't know how to do it because I need to kind of take time through things. And I understand something's quality through its density.
But if a consuming experience is easy, that doesn't necessarily mean that the time you spend reflecting on it is also easy.
That's kind of my
attitude towards art.
I tell you, I love an 80-page novel. Oh my God. Take it off on Goodreads. Read a book today. I love that feeling.
Yeah.
So maybe it's more complex than that.
But you hate a lot of short books, Dan.
I hate the mezzanine.
Gerald Murnane.
I hate Gerald Murnane. Well, look, I don't want to go on the record. We might get on the podcast at some point.
That's right. That's another throwback.
Yeah.
If you've listened this far,
thank you.
We love you.
Yeah.
We should generally say this is quite a nice place to tuck it. We have been so genuinely moved.
Oh, some people have listened to this podcast.
Which we genuinely didn't expect.
No, not at all. This was for us.
We are genuinely aware that we're sitting under a blanket, in my house, and that you can hear my housemates running up and down the stairs. Like, we're aware that this is not polished necessarily. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And if we can take advantage of our thanks, do like and subscribe, rate us on iTunes.
Send an email. I would love to get an email.
I've got the email on my phone now. If you send an email
to Dan's phone, will ping
the bradpittcast@gmail.com. I'll set up notifications exclusively for that email address.
Maybe we should have some questions. Who's your favorite five actors?
Yeah.
I'm genuinely obsessed with list making. Yeah, tell me your favorite five actors.
Yeah, and Dan, maybe we'll read it out on the podcast.
Hey, and next week Dan will have a list of five.
I will. I'll do my best.
Dan also needs to tweet @Daniel Dixon to tell him to fucking get a Letterboxd top four.
It's okay.
He doesn't have a Letterboxd.
My Letterboxd is currently very confusing. But yeah, harass me until I feel compelled to do it.
Sure. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you fucking Thelma and Louise.
See you then
with Brianna Elton.
Can't wait.